The third case for oral argument this morning is Dawn and Donald Novak, appellants versus Dennis McElbaum. The appellant is Jeff Cadle, an attorney from Washington Springs. Dell, thank you. Okay, well, this is like the previous case, substantial compliance. Mr. Johnson, attorney from St. Paul's representative. I should note that we've had two disqualifications in this case. Justice Sabres and Justice Sinner have disqualified themselves. Placements we've appointed to sit the Honorable Planning, the Circuit Judge from the First Circuit, Jack Delaney, the Circuit Judge from the Seventh Circuit here in Rapid City. Mr. Adele, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court. Major issue in this case is that the jury was not allowed to hear all of the relevant evidence that the plaintiff had. Most importantly, the jury was not allowed to hear the testimony of Heather Bird, a similarly situated victim of the defendant, who was sexually harassed in a way similar to the way that the plaintiff was. This evidence was found relevant by the trial court, but it was excluded because the trial court stated that the evidence was prejudicial. Now, as this court is aware, the standard of review in evidentiary rulings is generally abuse of discretion. If that standard is applied here, I think it's clear that the trial court did abuse its discretion. But I don't think we'd actually get to that point, Your Honor.
Well, this is a civil case where you're trying to get in other acts. Is it 404B that you
That's
are going
correct.
Under?
That's correct.
And so then, as far as in other cases, we've looked at what is the need for it? Principally, what are you pointing at as far as to prove your case? Now, admittedly, it showed that this employer, whatever, McElbaum or whatever, might not be the greatest guy in the world, but you still got to have it for what you're going to prove, what you got to show to the jury. So what is it that you want it for, other than to show he's a bad guy?
Your Honor, we want it for a few things. First of all, we want it for intent. Now, intent is obviously listed under SDCL 19.12.5 as a legitimate purpose for the introduction of other acts evidence. Intent is an element of battery. That's one of the things that plaintiff alleged. Intent is an element of intentional infliction of emotional distress.
That's you're not going to get negligent for opening and closing the territory that you alleged this act did it or he didn't, right?
Yes, but we still have to prove that it was intentional, that he didn't accidentally brush against her. Like that.
So you're saying that,
and the intent has to go to the infliction of emotional distress.
What the elements of the charge is, what you're trying to allege happened, and the court instructs them that under the elements of the proof of the cause of action, intent was there.
Yes, we have to prove the element of intent in order to prove battery and in order to prove intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's one of the elements. As this court has stated, that when that is one of the elements you have to prove, then it's an issue, even if the defense is a complete denial. But here it was not a complete denial. There were some of these acts that the defendant admitted that he did, but he claimed that he'd done them innocently. He didn't intend to cause any harm, cause any offense, anything like that. So his intent was an issue.
Now, so what you're saying that he opened the door?
Well, I believe the door is open anyway.
Well, I didn't ask you whether you believe it or not. You're saying, based upon his testimony, the door was open because he made a denial and said it was innocent or a mistake. And you're saying that it was intentional and you should have been able to show it through this other conduct? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. That's one of the reasons.
Why didn't the trial court allow it? What did he say?
Well, that's an interesting thing. When you look at the...
That's why we asked it. We wouldn't like to try to get it.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor. When you look at what the trial court actually said in its ruling, it never looked at any of the reasons that this other act evidence was being proposed. It never made any reference in its decision to intent or to plan, which we've also said it's necessary for, or relationship with the parties, which we've said it's necessary for. The trial court never looked at any of that.
Balance it like he's supposed to as far as the probity versus the prejudicial? He'd have to do that.
The only thing that the trial court said in that regard was that it was his opinion that the prejudicial effect was substantially outweighed the probative value. He made no analysis of the facts or the nature of the acts alleged. And in fact, he never found or stated at any point that the prejudice that this evidence would have would be unfair. Now, anything we put on is going to be prejudicial, but it has to be unfair prejudice. That was never argued by the defense, and it was never found by the trial court. In fact, in his brief to this court, the defendant has still never shown anything. He's never given any indication as to why the prejudice would be unfair. All that's ever been claimed is prejudice. What happened is there were assumptions made. The defense and the trial court both assumed prejudice would be unfair. They assumed that the unfair prejudice would outweigh both. Your Honor, it's the defendant's burden to show the unfair prejudice exists and show that it outweighs the probative value, and not only outweighs it, but substantially outweighs it.
Now,
defendants would not do that.
Would you rule on admission, say the trial court uses its discretion in error, right?
That's one of the things we're saying. I also...
But now, don't you have to then show that the prejudice to your case was inflicted in it?
And I think the prejudice is there, and that it's substantial and obvious. The other act.
If you think it's there, what is it? Tell me that.
The other act testimony would have established a defendant's intent. Would have shown that these acts were not done innocently, that they were not done with no intent to cause harm. That he had this the intent to cause battery, to cause intentional infliction of emotional distress. It also would go to showing a plan. We haven't really talked about that yet.
But you've got a judgment. The jury rules in your favor, right?
Not in regard to the battery or the intentional infliction of
emotional
distress.
Okay, so you just got it on the breach of contract.
That's correct, John.
So that you're then there just, what you're saying then is the prejudice is that you weren't able to prove the elements of what your cause of action was and the other two causes of action you had? Is that where we're at then?
We're at those, and also in regard to the claim of sexual harassment. Which the intent does, it doesn't go to intent so much in regard to sexual harassment, it does go to plan.
Did the jury get instructions on all these other causes of action?
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
Now they filed against it?
Yes, because they were not allowed to hear all of the relevant evidence.
Were there any other witnesses to these purported acts to testify whether they were just his word?
Essentially, when this evidence was excluded, it was turned into he said versus she said. And that gets into another element that you need to look at in these matters, which is the necessity of the admission of this evidence, and that goes to its probative value. When this evidence is necessary to prove the plaintiff's case, when there's no other evidence that is equally probative value, then the probative value must be given greater weight. And as this court has ruled, when we look at probative value versus prejudicial effect, we need to give the maximum weight probative value at the minimum weight to the unfair prejudice. The law favors admissibility of this sort.
Well, under 404B, it's sort of like a lot of it is not supposed to be convicted of prior things you've done. You should just be tried on what the charge is against you. Should it be relaxed when it comes to this type of an action?
No, Your Honor, and we're not arguing that it should be relaxed. We're simply arguing that it should be followed. This evidence was relevant in regard to intent, relevant in regard to plan. And again, we haven't really talked about how it was relevant in each of these cases, in each of these areas. In intent, what we're to look at is whether there are similar victims, whether there are similar acts. Now, looking at the victims, both Don Novak and Heather Bird, whose testimony we're trying to get in, had husbands who were employed by the defendant. They both had families who were entirely dependent on the defendant for their livelihood because they had no other source of income. They were both harassed by the defendant in homes that the defendant owned. They both began being harassed while they were helping out at the defendant's farm without being paid. They both were women who, because of the work situation of their husbands, had frequent contact with the in fact, were alone with the defendant at various times.
Did they have
I don't believe there would be a close similarity in regard to that. However, they were similarly situated.
Were they both similarly situated in the shower without a curtain?
No, and that gets to something as to where these acts occurred. And there in fact, is evidence in regard to Don Novak, what Heather Bird's testimony was, that the defendant would leave the bathroom door open and expose himself in the shower and so forth. But what we're getting to here is where the acts occurred. Some of them, all of the ones on Heather Bird did occur at the defendant's home. Some of the acts done on Don Novak also occurred in the defendant's home. Some of them occurred at the home that the defendant owned in town that the Novaks lived in. Some of them occurred on the job site. But to make a distinction between the job site and the home is really a distinction without a difference, because we're talking about a farming operation. The home is out on the farm site. That's really a distinction without a difference. Similarities where these acts occurred. Our other thing we look at is the similarity of the acts itself, by themselves. Both of these, there were similar acts in regard to making sexually suggestive comments, in regard to the defendant smelling the hair of both of them, smelling the skin of both of them, trapping each of them in a bathroom. There are definitely similar acts here, and the defendant is really not in his brief challenge the similarity of the acts. He simply challenged the similarity of the victim. Right, and so that's why we need to get to the intent issue.
What ways, if I might ask, did either the plaintiff or Heather indicate to Mr. McEldowney that his admitted or otherwise advances were unwelcome, disfavored?
They both told him that they didn't like that, that they were to stop it, that he was to stop it. Don Novak they both specifically told him that just knock that off or they would tell their husbands about it and that this would cause serious trouble. They were both making an attempt to put a stop to this. But because of their work situation, they were afraid to make too much of an effort because they were dependent on the defendant for their livelihood. They had no other income. The defendant thought he had them trapped, and that's why he acted in the way that he did, and that gets the plan. Heather Bird was not an employee. She was doing some work on a volunteer basis to help out. And that's the way Don Novak started. When Don Novak started working out there, she was just helping out too. She wasn't an employee. That's another similarity. Getting to the plan issue, the law says that under plan, which is again listed in 12.5, the legitimate purpose of admission of other acts evidence is to show a common plan, design, or scheme. That term refers to a larger continuing plan of which the present act is only a part, and it's relevant for a variety of reasons. Now, most of the really serious acts that were alleged by the plaintiff were not admitted by the defendant. So that puts plan in issue. This court has said that when the defendant denies doing an alleged act, evidence of a common plan or scheme to achieve that act is directly relevant refute that denial. By showing the other scheme has a strong resemblance to the pattern of what is alleged, the plaintiff shows a pre-existing plan or design, which in turn tends to show the doing of the act alleged. Now, defendant claimed that plan was only allowable when identity is an issue. The reading of the cases of this court shows that that's not correct. There are cases like State v. Andrzejczyk, State v. White, State v. Perkins, in which identity was not an issue, but evidence was allowed in to show a common plan or scheme. Even in Champaign, which the defendant cited in his brief, the court recognized that there could be other uses for plan evidence beyond identity. Now, the defendant has claimed that he didn't have any plan, just a series of connected acts which were innocently done. So the testimony of Heather Bird was relevant to show that a plan existed. Now, we've already discussed similarity, but I would also note to the court that when this plan evidence is used, reasons other than to prove identity, close similarity is not required. All that we have to show is that there are sufficient points in common and that there is a common plan. Now here, the plan was that the defendant sexually harassed the wives of his employees. The plan continued if the spouse became an employee. The plan was to intimidate these women through his position of power over them to accepting his sexual advances, because they had no other source of income and he had that power over them. He retaliated against them when they rejected him. clearly the testimony of Heather Bird was relevant to this issue of plan.
Did he retaliate?
Yes, he did. He withheld wages from the Novaks, fired Heather Bird's husband, Guy Bird. He did retaliate.
And I see where the trial court said, I find it very prejudicial because there's always a danger. There's a simple way to resolve this evidence. I'd assume that this evidence is suggestive of this person and of this act, and he acted this way on a particular case. Now, did you argue to the judge is that, you know, you can instruct the jury that they aren't supposed to consider? Isn't that what the judge is supposed to do?
Well, and we didn't argue that because this was the judge's decision. There wasn't a chance to argue that afterwards. The judge had made his decision. But this gets to...
But that's the standard instruction.
Yes, it is. And that's what.
And that evidence is limited to a certain purpose to be considered by a jury in a trial.
Yes, and that's what should have happened here. There should have been a limited instruction. This gets to the analysis by the trial court, if you want to call it an analysis. Because when it's in making that statement, that's not an appropriate standard for determining whether other act evidence comes in. Because there is always a danger there. No matter what the other evidence is, there's always a danger that there's going to be an unfair character inference made by the jury. But that's not the standard. As this court said, in the Wright case, almost any other act evidence simultaneously condemns by referencing character and also by showing intent, plan, or some other legitimate purpose for allowing the evidence. What the law says is that if the evidence is offered for a legitimate purpose, it comes in. It's only allowed for an unfair purpose. That gets to the unfair prejudice, the persuasion by illegitimate means. If it's allowed for a legitimate purpose, then it comes in. And there can be limited prejudice. That's not the trial court's basis for making the decision. It's not accordance with the law. The other statements the trial court made in that same area are also not relevant legal standards. One of the things the court stated was that this would cause a mini trial within the trial. That's not a relevant legal standard because that's what happens every time other act evidence comes in.
That's what it said in the Wright case. That's what we said in the Wright case, that you're entitled to have a hearing as to whether or not it actually occurred before you even let it in.
Yes, and in fact, in the Red Star case, which this court decided recently.
That was after Wright.
Right. The trial court reversed this court reversed the trial court precisely because it didn't allow the jury to make a determination as to whether this evidence was true or not. What happens when other act evidence comes in? The evidence comes in, the defendant is clearly allowed to challenge the evidence, challenge the credibility, however he wants to, and then the jury makes whether it believes the other act evidence is true. If it believes that, then it can consider this evidence in the present case. If it doesn't believe it, then obviously that's what it's
because
supposed to
happen. Because in the Red Star case, it was charged, it was an uncharged crime. It happened to be found that they were trying to offer. You're saying this is Red Star.
Yes, and in fact,
there
aren't
charges in this.
That's right. There aren't any charges. And in fact, when you look at the other act's law, it doesn't reference prior bad acts. It doesn't even reference bad acts. It just references other acts. So that's all we're talking about here, other acts.
Well, it wasn't bad acts.
Well, I suppose then the defendant would be wrong. It wasn't bad acts. But there's nothing to say, as this court has said, there's nothing that says the conduct has to be criminal or even wrongful. It just has to be an other act that is relevant to matter that we're looking at today.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you.
In most of the cases that you cited have dealt with criminal matters, cases where that statute doesn't preclude the use of civil.
That's right, and there are civil cases which the other act statute has. This generally does come up. So, Your Honor, I would say that, again, that these standards that the trial court was looking at, that mini trial within the trial, there's always the danger that there will be in character inference. These aren't relevant legal standards. The other thing the trial court said was that this sort of evidence is being less and less received. Now, you may agree with that analysis or you may not, but the fact is that's irrelevant to making a determination in this particular case. That's what we're looking at. supposed to be reviewing an analysis of the facts and the nature of the act and whether this evidence comes from the case. Observation on the general trends of the law is irrelevant. This evidence was relevant. It was found so by the trial court. The trial court simply eliminated it based on prejudice, and the trial court never found that there was unfair prejudice. It did not do its required balancing analysis. It did not do any analysis whatsoever. It was relevant to intent.
How can you say, is there any trick way to balance? It obviously, if he says the trial judge says it's prejudicial, he must have balanced something to get to that point, didn't he? Are you saying he's got to go through on the record and say, 1, 2, 3, 4, this way, 6 here is unbalanced? Or what do you say?
Well, this court has said many times that it is crucial that the trial court does conduct its analysis on the record. Now, I'm not saying he necessarily has to do it formally 1, 2, 3, 4, but he needs to identify the reasons that the other act evidence requested to come in. Conduct an analysis of the facts, nature of the acts, say whether to indicate whether he believes there was unfair prejudice, if so, where that unfair prejudice comes from, why that unfair prejudice substantially outweighs the appropriate value of the evidence.
Time is expired.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Pleasure to be here this morning. It's admittedly a bit nerve-wracking, but it's a pleasure to be here. Your Honors, this is a case tried in Wesson and Springs to a jury. The Honorable Eugene Martin. It's a hardworking, thoughtful, experienced, conscientious, learned trial judge.
Is that the issue in this case, whether or not he's learned as a trial judge? The issue in this case is whether he used his discretion.
Correct, Your Honor, and that's what I'm getting to.
Cite me to authority that says because he's been on the bench X number long, he's learned that it impacts the country.
What I'm getting to, Your Honor, is to get to the point that he did consider all of his facts in his analysis. I'd like to present to you the things that were presented to Judge Martin, what he did, and he considered all of it. Wasn't off the top of the head. This wasn't a situation where they weren't allowed to give an offer of proof, that type of thing.
He didn't allow the witness to testify.
He did not allow the witness to testify.
And they wanted to put that out.
However, he did allow them to summarize it. He did allow them to file a brief. In fact, he did file a brief setting forth all of their argument, setting forth the prior acts that they were attempting to get into law. Judge Martin.
Prior to trial that he filed that brief?
Correct, Your Honor. This was approximately sometime a week. Filed a brief. It's an 11-page brief sending it out. I'm not sure if it's part of the settled record yet or not. I saw on the clerk's certificate that was sent up that it had been removed for some reason.
That's our policy to review the trial briefs.
Judge Martin did specifically refer to it and asked it to be filed in this case to have that considered. Still up here. He also allowed them to give an oral summary of what the evidence was going to present. So Judge Martin had all of this argument before him. He had all of the evidence of what the prior bad acts were going to be. And in doing that, he then considered it. He looked under 404B. He looked at it. He did the two-part analysis. He ruled that it was relevant. He ruled that it was inclined to show the prior bad act or that this was inclined to show that he was doing these things. And then he specifically ruled that it was that the probative value was more prejudicial or outweighed the prejudicial. Prejudicial effect was greatly outweighed by the prejudice.
Why?
Saying that wrong. Sorry about that.
We know what you're trying to say.
I know
it. I want to ask you.
I appreciate
why?
That. Why? Why? All you have to look is page 28 of the plaintiff's brief to show why they want to get this in and why it would be so prejudicial. And I'm taking this as a quote from their brief. It shows the opportunity and inclination of the defendant to commit the acts alleged. It corroborates the charges of the plaintiff.
Well, you've got an instance here, very close in time. One person is hired 9, 10 days after the first one. You've got similar activities, part of which is admitted by the defendant. You've got no witnesses on it. Said she said. How is it prejudicial to bring in this kind of evidence to the system?
Your Honor, to some of the incidents, it was a he said, she said. However, to others, there were other witnesses around. Donald Novak was present. He was an employee there to some of the things that we're talking about. The judge weighed this and his mind, did the analysis, and felt that the jury, because of these other testimony, the other prior bad acts, or the post-bad acts, I guess I should say, that they would be unduly prejudicial against the defendant in this, and too much inclined, because of this other act, not decide this case based upon the evidence presented by the jury. He felt that was too prejudicial, and in his analysis, he felt that it needed to be excluded. And trial judges, evidentiary rulings are presumed to be correct. And of course, trial judges have standard of review is abuse of discretion. It's not whether another judge would have made the same decision or not. It's whether no judicial mind could come to the same reasonable conclusion.
Did Judge Martin put anything on the record itself that showed what his finding?
Your Honor, thank you for that question. He did go through, and he talked about in the trial or in the motions hearing transcript. He did not specifically cite facts, but he went through the analysis and he said, okay, under 404B, it can't be admitted to try and prove inclination towards committing this, but there are those exceptions. He went through and he named those exceptions. And then he went through the analysis and said, I find this evidence to be relevant.
Is that the conclusion?
I think it's part and parcel of the same, and his balancing of it. And I'd like to also point out that the plaintiff in this case never asked the judge to give anything more specific. The plaintiff in this case is asked if the judge should have issued a written decision or findings of fact. That was never requested. No findings of fact were proposed by the
judge. Do you agree with Judge Martin's observation that the evidence was relevant?
Your Honor, we argued at the time that it was not relevant, that it should not have come in, but that was the judge's decision in his analysis.
So that must leave you to argue it. The
question is whether it's an abuse of discretion.
And there's no because of undue prejudice.
What's that?
Because of undue prejudice.
Correct.
You've already lost on the relevance grounds, apparently.
Well, the judge ruled it was relevant, and what he said is relevant on the issue of the inclination of committing these acts because of the other acts. He didn't specifically say it was relevant on the issue of intent, or plan, or motive. He simply said it.
I remember the Luke case that I had done and testifying about an incident with a girl and then she gave testimony during the course of the trial whereby he denied me and in a way blessed this girl. And at that time, he made that denial. He allowed in evidence of prior conduct. Now, it seems as though counsel has said your client opened the door by some of his testimony and did not. What do you say to that?
Your Honor, that was never argued at the trial. It's never been argued on appeal until just now. It was brought up that somehow it was opening of the door. That's never been presented to the trial court.
So there was never a renewal of the motion and once the trial started?
There was a time when, during trial, when he allowed the summary of the offer. His decision.
So then what you're saying is possibly when the door would have been open, there was no motion made at that time to reopen to re-offer this proof because of the fact that he's opened the door on the material fact we have. That isn't in this record.
That issue is not in this record.
It seems to me, or I guess what I want to ask is what sort of other acts by someone accused of sexual harassment would be admissible without being unduly prejudicial?
I think it would have to depend on the circumstances, what's trying to be proved. It's hard to believe that on the intent issue that it was that the claim that he came up behind her and grabbed her breasts was unintentional. That was never a claim that was unintentional. The claim was, and the denial is, that it just never happened. And the jury heard that and understood that and ruled Dennis McNamara's favor.
But that doesn't address my question. If someone's accused of showing pictures of naked women to his female employees, would doing that with other female employees be admissible?
I think you have to go on the circumstances, Your Honor. In some cases, it may be. In others, it may not.
Well, in sorry, which case, what circumstances would make it admissible?
Your Honor, I don't know.
I'm trying to think of anywhere it wouldn't be. Can you think of anywhere it wouldn't be?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, as I sit here today. I just haven't thought through that question. And I appreciate it, but I just haven't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, are you saying that there's nothing that was required as far as this evidence was saying the trial court was correct? Because you said it was relevant. And they've got to prove what the elements of the cause of action is. And they've got to make a showing why it's needed to prove one. Are you saying they didn't make that?
Can you repeat that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Well, excuse me. I'm probably not too clear. I'm getting old. But anyway, when you want to offer this evidence in, you have to have a reason for it. You have to say, I need it. It's material. I need it to prove my case. And because in my cause of action against this individual, I have to show that he did A. And this helps me show it. It shows that I can prove it. Was that done here, is what I'm asking.
Your Honor, they have the opportunity through Don Novak, through Donald Novak, other witnesses to introduce all of the evidence concerning what she claims Dennis McElveen did. What the trial court excluded was evidence of something that Heather Byrd, an entirely unrelated situation, is claiming, a case that's not involved here, is claiming. And so, yes, they had the opportunity to prove all of that. They had the opportunity to put that evidence in. The question here, number one, what is the reason that they're actually trying to get this in? It's to try and show bad character. Bad act, an inclination towards trying to do these things. Look at their brief, and that statement right in there tells you that. But as far as the intent, they had the opportunity to talk about all of the circumstances that Don Novak claims happened to her. So yes, they did have the opportunity to prove all of the elements of their claim. The jury heard that evidence and decided against them.
Did he admit or deny that he, in the proceedings that were had regarding Heather, did he admit that he had done those things?
In the proceedings with Heather?
Yes, sir.
I do not believe that that ever was in the record that he admitted doing those things to Heather.
Well, did he deny them?
He did not, during the trial, deny them. But yes, he denies the allegations of Heather Byrd, if that's what you're asking. Heather Byrd has started her own lawsuit against Dennis McElveen. And yes, he has denied all of those allegations. Other questions, Your Honor?
Other questions?
I have a question regarding the 1995 incident.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was excluded. Why should that be?
1995 incident should be excluded because what we're talking about here is acts that allegedly started in the fall of 1997. The lawsuit was brought sometime approximately 3 years after that. But we're talking about a 1995 incident. Single alleged incident, which Dennis McElveen denies, that then had a period of more than 2 years in between them.
Why was there? Were they not together?
No, there was still contact between them. For those 2 years, her husband continued to work for him through those years, and she continued helping out. But what the trial court, there really were two reasons that the trial court excluded it. Number one was it was outside of the statute of limitations. Battery, that was a battery claim, so it would be a 3-year statute of limitations there, and it was outside the statute of limitations, and the court found that. The court also ruled that it wasn't any kind of a continuing tort because it was just a separate, distinct act with no connection between 1995 and 1997. It wasn't as if it was a continuing representation by a doctor or an accountant or an attorney. It wasn't a continuing leak like we had in the one case where city pipes were leaking, found a continuous tort. There simply was a separate alleged act. The other thing is, Your Honor, that was never alleged in the complaint. The complaint simply starts out with 1997 acts. Unless the court has other questions.
Was there an amendment to the complaint? Is that in there?
No, Your Honor, that was never amended. The complaint was never amended. Our answer was allowed to be amended that morning to a certain statute of limitations.
Anything further for Mr. Sutton?
Yes, sir, if I might. It's as near as I can tell, materials I have, portions of the record and the briefs, your client, Mr. McEldowney, admitted a number of things. Admitted smelling the plaintiff's hair, correct?
Correct.
And her arm?
Correct.
He admitted looking down the front of her shirt?
In an incident prior to her working, yes.
Telling her that he would take off his shirt if she would take off hers?
That, yes, he did admit to that.
Telling her dirty jokes?
I think there was a discussion, yes, where he said that those kind of jokes were told.
Showing her pictures of women with little clothing on them?
Pictures from the Sturgis bike rally, Your Honor. Yes, no nudity. No nudity.
By definition, that's probably the same.
No nudity, but yes, women in bikini-type outfits.
Discussing the specific sexual matters from the Clinton-Lewinsky matter?
Yes. Some, to some extent.
Telling her he would set her up elsewhere?
Not in a sexual context. The question was, I guess the record speaks for itself, Your Honor, but no, I don't think that was in a romantic situation. That wasn't Dennis McEldowney making the moves on her, saying that he could set her up elsewhere. It was a situation where if she was having marital problems with her husband, he would do what he can to try and help her.
And had she indicated to him that she did not welcome these things?
She says she did. Dennis McEldowney denies doing these things, so no. The question is, how can you say that she did, that she tried to tell him to stop these things when they didn't happen, other than the things that you're talking about?
These things are not viewed by your client as sexual harassment.
No, Your Honor. What we have to remember is we're working in a hog confinement center. This is a large hog confinement center, and what Dennis McEldowney's doing at the time, he's very careful about being sensitive in the community about not having the smell of pigs leave his farm. Hog confinement centers are a hot political item, and he was concerned about that. And so he wanted to make sure that in smelling her hair, that it didn't smell like pig manure when she left the farm and returns to town.
Pig manure smell on her hair, he's going to run into a political problem.
Your Honor, in a small community like this, hog confinement centers, yes. You have a situation that's a hot political item, and there's a lot of people that are against these hog confinement centers.
Of hot political items that never seen
he was concerned about taking the smell of the hog confinement center into town. Working in a hog confinement center, you don't have to be in the hog confinement unit very long before your hair, body, and clothes start reeking of hog manure.
What's his political reason?
Your Honor, it is a small farm. It's husband-wife community. He'd gone out to Sturgis with his wife, came back and showed him pictures of their trip.
I suppose his wife showed pictures of his husband and her out.
Oh, I don't know about that, Your Honor.
Any further questions for this?
If I may, Your Honor, this doesn't relate to the case, but I do want to say that I truly appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. This is not meant to be patronizing in any way, but I very much enjoy being a lawyer. I very much enjoy our judicial system and the opportunity to appear before trial judges and the Supreme Court, which emphasizes what a wonderful system we have. I appreciate that.
Say, you also, I've noticed, enjoy yard work, which is...
Counsel, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
I would like to get into a little bit about the burden. Once evidence is found relevant, our case is staged, the defense has a burden to show why the evidence should not be allowed into evidence, why there is prejudice, why there is unfair prejudice, why that unfair prejudice substantially outweighs the probative value of this evidence. The defense has shown nothing to show any of that. It's all been just assumed. There is no way that you can look at the record in this defense met any sort of burden.
Well, let me ask you this. The constable said that the trial court took briefs, assumed both sides.
We submitted a brief.
and looked at it, and he didn't look at it in a vacuum. He must have known something that was going to happen, right?
That's right.
Because you had proposed what you wanted, and they apparently had objected to it. So somehow the trial court found that the burden was shown that it was more prejudicial, didn't he?
There is nothing in the record that reflects that the trial court found that a burden was met by the defendant, or that the trial court even recognized that he had a burden. And again, we're having to make assumptions as to what the trial court must have thought, because there's nothing on the record to show us what the trial court thought.
But you had a motion hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then he ruled prior to trial on it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So you had to hear something at the motion hearing. You don't just go in and say, I got a motion, and then he says, well, I'll decide later. Did you have testimony or anything at that time?
There was no testimony admitted at that time, Your Honor. All there was argument by both sides, and the defendant never argued unfair prejudice. The trial court never found them.
And how did it first come in front of the trial court? Was it on your motion?
No, it was on the defense motion.
They moved to evidence. To deny the admission of it.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would also like to get into the one statement from our brief that the defense keeps harping on, and you have the briefs. You can see the context in which that statement. It's in regard to a discussion of admitting this evidence to define the relationship of the parties, which this court has said is legitimate reason for allowing other act evidence. What we're talking about there is exactly what this court said in State versus Lively, when it said that the rationale for admissibility of evidence to define the relationship of the parties is that a person's conduct in a certain context tends to explain that person's conduct and interactions in a similar context. Again, what we're looking at is the similarity of what happened, the similarity of the other act's evidence. So that's the context in which that statement was made, and I'm sure you can see that when you read the brief.
Were you trying to get the 95 incident prior act, other act?
We were trying to get the 95 incident in as a continuing court, Your Honor. There is also an argument there in regard to failure of the defense to move to exclude that evidence and to defend its complaint in compliance with the scheduling order.
Is Mr. Song correct as to the facts that nothing occurred between 95 and 97?
He's correct, Your Honor, but the record reveals nothing to show that there was any opportunity for anything to happen in that 2-year break. This court looked at some similar facts of civil sexual misconduct case in the case of Shippen versus Parrott. And what the court held in that case was that continuing tort theory can apply in case of sexual misconduct, things like battery, intentional infliction of emotional distress. Now, it didn't apply that theory in that case, but we need to look at the facts of that case to see why. Now, in that case, there was a 4-year break sexual misconduct that was alleged, but it wasn't just the fact of a break that was the important issue there. What was really important was that during that 4-year period, the plaintiff and the defendant continued to have a relationship. It wasn't a sexual relationship. They were friends, they continued to see each other, they communicated frequently. In other words, there were opportunities for sexual misconduct to have occurred during
that
4-year
period. Was that the banker
period. I think so, Your Honor.
Off to school, and then he came up to visit. So there wasn't that type of contact. In that case, he was attempting to have contact with the
That's correct.
So there wasn't that break there.
Well, but for 4 years, there was a break. There was. When you look at that case, it was a 3 or 4 year break, I can say for sure.
So
but again, there were opportunities for sexual misconduct to occur, but it didn't occur. The defendant voluntarily stopped misconduct during that break, and that's why it wasn't a continuing course of conduct.
Was there opportunity?
There's nothing in the record that reflects that, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to show that the defendant and Don Novak were ever alone in a situation where the defendant could have sexually harassed her. That break between the 1995 incident and 1997. What happened in the 1995 incident was that Dawn Novak, without helping for a brief time at the defendant's farm, because her husband, Donald, who was employed by the defendant, gotten injured. He had his hand in the cast. He couldn't work. Work needed to be done. Dawn didn't want her husband to get fired. So Dawn went out there and did the work during, during that six-week period. And that's when the first incident of sexual harassment and emotional distress occurred. Then, the next time, Dawn was helping Dennis McElbounty. They were alone in 1997. Dennis McElbounty was shingling up on the roof on the house that the plaintiffs were allowed to live in. And there was another incident of sexual harassment on that.
Then after the 95, when the husband came to she didn't go out there.
That's right. That's right, yeah. So what we're saying is because there were no opportunities for this misconduct to have occurred in that time, it was a continuous tort. There was continuously wrongful conduct. Does the court have any further questions?
I would ask, what do you believe this court is supposed to do on the record to preserve the record showing this man's is there going to be a specific finding of fact stating this fact one, two, three, there are is that what you're saying is required?
I don't think has to be in that formal a fashion. I don't think it has to be in writing necessarily, although there are cases where that happen. It can be orally and it doesn't necessarily have to be 1, 2, 3, but the court does have to indicate this is the reason that the evidence is being offered into evidence. This is why it is either relevant to that purpose or it's not relevant to that purpose. It is relevant. This is why there either is or is not unfair prejudice. There is unfair prejudice. This is why there is that unfair prejudice does or does not outweigh probative value and substantially outweigh
probative value. I think we've also said that there's some obligation on it. And it says that in order to have an heir preserved, the attorney to make sure that they get a trial court. We all know appearing in front of a judge is necessary popularity time. He hasn't made the right ruling. Shouldn't you have the obligation to say, Judge, you haven't made my record. I need my record. I want to know why it's prejudicial, why it outweighs. You haven't said that. All you've just gone off in a generic form and said it. Isn't that incumbent upon you to get that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it is, and I don't think it's the case law that says that it is.
You're saying that he was there.
Yes, Your Honor. And
you've
got
to be able to rule on it. You've got to point it out, though.
There are cases which have overturned the trial court based on the fact that it made a generic ruling, based on the fact
which
that...
Which one's
it
that?
Not, just a moment, Your Honor. I know one of them is State versus Steele. I have some other examples.
Okay, well, that's good. I remember Steele.
Okay. Which the court, this court specifically held the trial court cannot make a generic finding. It has to make its findings and analysis on the record. That analysis on the record is important.
That's what I'm saying. You're there. You can tell him.
And yeah. We can tell him, but none of those cases indicated that that was our burden to tell him that. And again, Your Honor, we did make an offer of proof.
What I'm saying is if you think that's an error, you should be able to sit back and just let it go along with it and then claim it up here.
And after the trial court made its initial ruling at the hearing, we did then, at trial, offer of proof, try to correct this error.
Put your brief in.
Well, the brief was in earlier. Did make an offer of proof at the trial, try to correct this error. Denied again. Did try to point out these errors and had no success.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.